Neil Steubenhaus is clearly one of the top A-list bassists in the music business, and he doesn't need to preach it. It's proven with his discography and the select artists that he's been able to work with throughout his career. He's sometimes under the radar, but he's been on ours for a long time, and we're happy to have him as a guest on Inside MusicCast. From his early years with Blood, Sweat, and Tears to playing with Gino Vannelli, from Larry Carlton to Charisma, Steubenhaus is about as solid as they come. He's got something to say about the craft of playing the instrument, as well as the industry in general. Inside MusicCast is pleased to welcome Neil Steubenhaus. Hey, Neil, thanks for joining us.
You're more than welcome. Happy to be here.
Well, no, you're welcome.
Well, you've been on our hot list for a long time, I hope I don't butcher his name, but I want to somebody that assists you. His name is Laurent Bialy. Is that correct?
Laurent, yes. Yeah. Laurent kept asking me if I had heard from you.
Yeah.
Going back months, and I kept reviewing the emails and saying, "Wait a second, I don't ever remember that." But so finally, he mentioned it again, and I just decided to send you an email and say, "Are you looking for me?"
Well, we got.
I guess you were.
One way or the other, we're glad.
Yeah, Laurent is absolutely fantastic. He's one of those that I was speaking about a minute ago of the real, you know, the real the fans from Europe who know their stuff,
right.
Who dissect everything. They know
all
the little tiny intricacies of all the different musicians and who's done what and how it added to a project, and they know what the business doesn't know.
Right.
And
and
Laurent's been invaluable to me. He does what I won't do, which is, you know, do all that technical stuff, website and promotion,
right.
And I'm probably the worst at promotion anybody could be. It's just not my thing.
Well, yeah, we wanted to thank him because he's the one who connected us to you.
Definitely.
And like I said, you've been on our list for a long time, so we're glad to have you on the show.
Absolutely.
Hey, we're going to step back. We're going to kind of go back to, like we do a lot of times with our guests, and go back and kind of talk about your path to the music business. One of the things that I know about you is that you grew up in a musical household. And I know that your mom played piano. Your siblings were also into music. But, you know, you started off playing drums as your first instrument, and that was around the time you were 7 years old. But you picked up the guitar and eventually the bass, you know, a few years later. And I just tell us a little bit about how the bass became your primary instrument.
Well, it's a detailed story, and I don't know how much time allows, but the long and short of it, if I can hopefully do that, it's easier to say
we've got time
than it is to be long and or short.
Go for it.
I had a fascination with rhythm, and for my 7th birthday, I wanted a pair of bongos. So I got the bongos, and I also got instructions to take drum lessons, which I didn't see coming because I really didn't want drum lessons. I just wanted to bang on some bongos. So I ended up in drum lessons, had a drum pad and all that stuff, and for about a year, I was playing on a pad, and, you know, I think I was 8 when I got my first snare drum. And it evolved, and I started playing, got a set of drums, a set of sonars back then, and by the time I was 10 or 11, I was in a band. I played. It wasn't very good, but I actually was making, you know, playing gigs that paid $10 or whatever it was back then. And I took up interesting guitar because my sister came home one day from some class. She was taking some, you know, a big, large class of guitar students, and she had a really junky nylon string guitar, and she showed me a few things I showed her, and I picked it up, and I liked it, and I just kept playing it. She did not. She picked up piano lessons from my mother, which I couldn't quite do, but I wish I did. And so I learned the guitar, and it didn't take much time at all to realize that I was getting pretty good and a lot better than the guitar player that was in this band I was playing with. So I started a new band, and I played guitar. And I had a buddy who played drums and a few others, and I taught the bass player. We went through a few bass players, but I always taught the bass player every single thing to do, realizing that I never had run across a bass player in a band that I was in when I was 14 that had any bass instincts at all. So I did. And it was starting to really sink into me that I did. And as I went around to hear the killer bands in town, I was always fascinated with the bass players the most. And I started taking, at the time, as I was getting better on guitar, I took lessons from a guy named Vinny Cusano. Vinny ended up being changing his name to Vinny Vincent.
Okay.
He recognized the name from his stint with Kiss.
Yeah, yeah.
I've had long talks with.
I was wondering.
So with the drummer who's in Kiss and with Gene Simmons, and they have some very interesting stories to say.
I'm sure they do.
But I was 14 and he was 16, and he had a car, and we drove around, and he gave me guitar lessons. And one day he said, "Let's." The bands that he was in were so good that I was mesmerized, and he and a few others that were local in Connecticut. And I went, when his band had ended, and he said, "Let's start a band." He said, "Except that I'm a better guitar player than you." And I said, "That's right." And he said, "Why don't you play bass?" I said, "Okay." That's actually it. I said, "Okay." And I grabbed some money and I went down to, first I grabbed a Hofner bass from his friend Skip, and that bass got ruined in about a week from leaving it out in the cold weather.
Oh my God.
And so I went to Manny's and I bought a Precision and a couple of Sun amps that I saw John Entwistle using. I thought they were the coolest looking things. Yeah. I didn't know how they sounded, but they looked cool. So I bought that. I just bought it.
Very cool.
And I was a bass player. Yeah. Presto changeo, just like that.
Wow. Just like that.
And I didn't really look back.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, you agreed to. You said okay.
I liked it, and I knew that I knew instinctively that, you know, Will Lee and I had this discussion going way back, mm-hmm. that back then there wasn't a lot of focus on bass. I don't think half the Beatles fans really understood Paul McCartney's role in the band, because other hot bands didn't have a bass player. The Young Rascals, for example, you know, kicked pedals and. And there was not a real focus, and there weren't really great bass players. There were just very good, terrific, functional bass players in all those British bands and what have you, but nobody focused on it a lot, and it just seemed like there was two good reasons to play bass. One was that I just instinctively loved it. I loved everything about it, and I picked up off everything off the records, you know, whether it was a Rolling Stones record or Vanilla Fudge, hard or not, easy. They were all hard to hear because audio, you know, was really lousy back then.
Yeah,
it was hard to pick apart the bass parts. But I worked at it, and I got them, and I played it, and I loved it. And that was so. It was a natural move for me.
You know, another interesting thing about what you were talking about, how the bass was sort of maybe not recognized as much in music back during that time. You know, you almost have to think about what people were listening on at that point, and really low frequency wasn't quite as prominent as it is today in terms of, you know, our playback systems. You know,
that's what I was saying. The audio was pretty, actually, so incredibly bad.
Yeah.
And the mixes and the way and the delivery systems that everybody had a little phonograph with a tiny speaker.
Exactly.
And only the musicians understood the function of the bass completely.
Right.
You know, all you had to do was listen to Beach Boys records even before the Beatles and. You know, it was also brilliantly put together, but only the musicians knew that.
Right. Yeah.
The general public didn't really understand what they were hearing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They just knew they liked it.
Right. Yeah. Well, that explains a lot of what you said about, you know, being young and having an inclination and love towards rhythm, which brings me to fast forward, because you arrived at Berkeley. We know that. And in 75, you graduated. But while there, you met a lot of guys that are very familiar to our audience, such as Steve I, Vinny, and JR, and probably others, too. But many others.
And by the way, as a matter of honesty, I never graduated.
Yeah, no big deal, but that's in
a way.
No,
I mean, I don't mean that in a good or bad way, but yeah. I went to Berkeley. I did a year and a half with Little Anthony and the Imperials on the road.
Yeah.
And that experience was very valuable, but I knew I wanted to get out of it.
I see.
And it just seemed that if I moved to Berkeley, it was just loaded with a concentration of great musicians.
Yeah.
I knew that. I knew that from the ones who were already there, you know, that I wanted to just even meet. And Berkeley was the center of the whole thing.
Yeah. Sure.
You know, whether people were going to school or not,
they
were living in Boston and working out of Boston.
Sure.
And so it was just the perfect, musical conglomeration. Everybody who was anybody in the learning field was there. So I moved and enrolled in Berkeley for 2 years.
Yeah, but you did.
And then they offered me a job teaching bass privately at Berkeley. So I did that for 2 years instead of continuing with the rest of it.
Yeah, and that was because of your relationship with Steve Swallow.
It was because Steve Swallow was, quote unquote, my electric bass teacher, even though he was only there once a month for a half an hour. But we I just loved the guy. We talked all the time. We played over some things. And then when he'd leave town, he would have me sub for his ensembles. And he'd give me all this Carla Bley material, you know, cut to 40 years later. The irony is he's married to her. Well, it is pretty fascinating to me.
Yeah, interesting.
On a separate note, but I loved talking to Steve. He was brilliant, and he had a completely, you know, transitional upright to electric, concept. It was nothing like the way I played. He played with a pick, but everybody loved Steve Swallow. He was like a god over there.
Yeah.
But he wasn't around very much. He and Pat Metheny were just taken off with Gary, so they just left all the time, and he left me with his ensembles. And then when he was going to quit, he said, you're the guy. He said, do you want to do this? So I thought about it, and I thought, well, you know, do I keep going to school with all the classes that I'm not all that interested in?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe I'll learn more about bass, having one-on-one with 40 kids a week.
Interesting.
And that's what it was. And I actually learned more about playing and reading from sitting down with people across from me. I learned from the students too.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were way ahead of me. I was into Jaco, you know, and some of them were into Stanley. So they taught me, you know, that stuff.
Yeah.
And a couple of the students that I studied, studied all the Jaco stuff.
Well, you know,
that's how it evolved. I was there for 4 years, but not as a student.
Yeah. I see. Okay. I see. Shortly after that time, you connected with David Clayton Thomas and joined Blood, Sweat, and Tears. I think that was maybe around 77. But tell us about some of that time in between, like, you know, that time when you were in Boston and meeting up, you know, meeting David Clayton Thomas and joining the band. And I was wondering, I know you eventually connected with Larry Carlton also, but when did you actually migrate to L.A. and what was happening during that time?
Well, it had nothing to do with David.
First of all,
The band, I was friendly with Jaco. We enjoyed each other's company, and mm-hmm. I lent him basses and amplifiers when he came to town to play with Pat.
Wow, cool. Wow.
And so he was probably easily the most interesting character I've ever met in my life.
I'll bet.
And of course, as it all turned out, you know, we all idolized him.
Right.
So what happened was I had a band that I worked 6 nights a week with that had my wife at the time singing and a couple of great musicians. Steve Smith was the original drummer in the band. He ended up going out on the road with Jean-Luc Ponty and meeting Journey and doing that as a career. And then and Vinnie Colaiuta was in the band for a bit. He'd sit in and he'd get us fired. Actually, he and Steve both got us fired. But Steve more so, because he played a lot louder and he played so loud and so obliviously to the nature of the gig of being a club, you know, in a bar where you had to be cognizant of your surroundings and what to do and what not to do. and all that stuff was great, but that somewhere at the end of my run of my second year teaching at Berkeley, it was Mike Stern who called me.
Oh, okay.
And Mike said, "Hey, Steuben Blobin is code for my name." And he said, "Are you ready?" He said, "Pack your bags." He said, "We start next week." He said, "We got this guy, you know, for a couple of months, and it didn't work out." And what had happened previous to that was that Jaco, who was did his first album produced by Bobby Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
Jaco did two months with the band, and he also recommended me, but they had some other guy that somebody didn't like or whatever. Something happened for a short period of time, and Mike said, "Pack your bags." We started at Summit. There was no rehearsal, nothing. And I went out there, and that was that. But that was through Mike Stern.
Interesting.
I see. All right. Well, tell me, just in a nutshell, tell us how you connected with Larry Carlton, because you toured with him in around 78 or so.
I did. My Blood, Sweat, and Tears had a bad ending. We had a bad situation with a band member who OD'd in Amsterdam.
Oh,
and that, and so Bledsoe and Tears just stopped, because that probably would have gone on for a long time, because
yeah.
it was fun, and it was my first time ever with a whole group of really great musicians, older guys,
yeah.
you know, great horn players. Larry Willis was the piano player. This guy was just a mentor to me, teaching me Wayne Shorter tunes and Herbie tunes, and you know, we talked about that era all day long, and Blood, Sweat, and Tears ended abruptly that January. So
wow.
the drummer, whose name was a good friend of Jaco's, named Bobby Economo, Bobby made some phone calls. Chuck Mangione was a good friend of his.
Mm-hmm.
And so he called Chuck, and Chuck said, my brother's looking for a band. His brother was Gap Mangione. And
yeah.
Gap was being produced by Larry.
Okay.
Larry Carlton.
Okay.
And so we went out and did a week in Annapolis or something. Mike Stern and me and Bob Economo with Gap. Mike and Gap did not get along.
Really?
So another gig came along a month later, and I flew to Denver, and there was this guy named Carlos Rios, this guitar player.
Yeah.
And Carlos took to me, you know, just completely, and we're still best friends to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And Carlos said, you know, Larry Carlton is looking for a band, and he's been auditioning bass players, and you've got to give it a shot. So, you know, and I was still kind of floundering around Boston wondering what to do. I was actually looking at apartments in New York and trying to make a move. And so the last gig we did with Gap Mangione on this particular tour we did was at the Roxy in L.A.
Okay.
And Larry came, and he set up an audition through Carlos the following day before I flew home. And Larry hired me from Boston.
Wow.
So that's why I moved out to L.A.
Oh, very cool. Well, you know, I was thinking about Blood, Sweat, and Tears and Larry Carlton. Those are, you know, two pretty big gigs for you. And you know, there were some common musical threads between the two, but the musical approach probably was, you know, slightly different. But these two gigs were just, you know, prior to your foray into session work when you got out into L.A. So I'm assuming that these two gigs, you know, played well on your resume, you know, in moving forward with this session work.
I honestly don't think a resume has any value or weight in the world of freelance musicians.
Okay.
I think resumes are for teachers.
That's okay.
Just my gut feeling about it.
Yeah.
Resumes are for people who need experience and need to have something on paper. So nobody cares. They hear you play. In the music world, you know, they hear you play, they think, oh, I like this guy. That's it. There's no other discussion. It didn't matter. I don't think Larry cared or what I did. He auditioned me the next day. He had heard a few guys, and he just decided, well, you know, this is the guy I want. If he's willing to move out to L.A., then so be it. You know, because he wasn't paying any money, so it was really a matter of, you know, it was a quid pro quo where,
right.
you know, I'll be your retainer, $100 a week or whatever,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
I'll make sure you can exist, and you get to move to L.A. and play with my band. And he had gigs booked. He had four or five months. We toured all over the States, and then we went to Japan. He said, but you do need to move to L.A. So I flew out there for a day, and Larry had a good friend who had a place he had just bought, you know, for a rental property investment. And it was cheap, and it was okay, and I said, I'll take it. And that was the end of that. So I just set it up, and I had to get out of Boston because there was nothing to do. You know, I couldn't keep teaching for $5 an hour. That was
right.
dumb. And it was also kind of, you know, in the 70s, it was a dead end. They're all migrating there now because it's not a dead end. It's actually quite a center for, you know, for all professional musicians to
right.
float in and out of.
Yeah.
It's a whole different ballgame now.
Yeah. Well, you know, and what I meant by resume, though, is not so much something that you could show to other people, but actually for yourself. I mean, obviously,
yeah.
you know, you had some great experience with those two, and that, you know, that probably helped you, you know, move into, you know, some other gigs with people. You know, just that experience
yeah.
you had with Larry and Blood, Sweat, and
Yeah,
Dears.
I knew you meant it metaphorically.
Right, exactly.
I didn't mean to go off on that. But it's the same answer. Not really. I don't really think anybody,
yeah.
you know, cares
yeah.
of... You know, that's more conversation stuff when, you know, when somebody's introducing you. I don't think Blood, Sweat, and Tears even really came up very much.
Okay.
Because it was already past the Blood, Sweat, and Tears prime.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, it was more of a revolving door where, yes, they were in the studio trying to make a record with Bobby Columbia producing again, but it didn't matter anymore. The band had already gone past its heyday, but with that kind of with that kind of band, you can gig forever.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. Yeah,
it
exactly.
doesn't mean the gigs are going to pay, and it doesn't mean it's going to be a big
true,
deal.
Right.
But you can, you know, they're all out there touring. Everybody wants to make a living off something, you know, they created 30, 40, mm-hmm. 50 years ago, and they do because they have to.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we got a chance to interview, well, Mike Post. It was a few years back, right, Rick?
Yeah, 4 or 5 years
ago. You know, at that time he was, you know, in his day he was the undisputed, you know, king of television themes and scores, you know. And it was Larry Carlton who connected you to Mike, wasn't it?
Larry had, you know, what we discussed, that if I moved out to L.A., that Larry would make a few phone calls and mm-hmm. introduce me to the studio world.
Yeah.
And there was a point in time where, you know, candidly, he really didn't. He had his mind on other things. He didn't, and I pushed him, and I said, you know, Larry, we talked about this back in July, and it's almost a year later. It's kind of time. And so Larry did two things. And in those days, as Jay Graydon calls it, the musical lottery
that
we lived through, because it's not that way now. It is not that now.
No. Yeah, right.
In those days, any, like in a dry woods, you know, one little spark can just catch.
Right.
And, you know, that's the way it worked back then. So Larry called Mike Post on the phone and said, you know, whenever your regular guys can't make it, give Neil a chance. And he did. And that led to a lot of things. Larry did one other thing. He introduced me to a jingle writer by the name of Don Pystrup,
okay.
who was one of the most unknown geniuses in the entire music business.
Interesting.
Absolute genius. He's the John Williams of you know, orchestrated commercials, which, of course, those don't exist anymore either.
Yeah, sure,
Don's retired. But his stuff was brilliant, and his regular bass player played with Neil Diamond. Riney Press, his name is.
Okay.
And Riney had a full-time gig with Neil Diamond and didn't really want to do any studio work anymore.
I see.
And I eventually became Don's main bass player, and I was there a lot. And that was because of Larry.
Look at
Larry
that.
Larry, you know, said, try my guy if Ryan can't make it. Just like that. And he did.
And interesting.
Hal Blaine was there all the time. They were great musicians there.
Wow. Yeah.
And those were the only two connections that really Larry connected.
Look at that.
And through Mike Post's gigs, I met Tom Scott, I met Victor Feldman, I met all these great musicians
right.
who were all doing that. You know, everybody, it's surprising, but, you know, it was shocking for me to go to an 8:30 a.m. Rockford Files recording at Universal, not knowing where I'm going, and I'm lost, and I'm carrying an amp, and I didn't even know that, you know, you're supposed to just call somebody and have it delivered. and there's Ian Underwood from the Mothers of Invention that I used to listen to.
Wow.
And Tom's, all these great musicians were all doing these television gigs.
Yeah.
That's how they made a living, you know,
absolutely.
Outside of all the other stuff they did maybe at night. I mean, Shelley Mann was one of the main drummers over at Universal.
Right.
And there were a lot of great players. Mm-hmm. And that one Mike Post phone call ended up just leading to these other things.
That was the spark.
And that's how I met Tom Scott, who called me out of the clear blue sky, and I started recording with him. And it really did take off.
That's so cool.
Just from that.
Well, you know, you were fortunate to come along at a time when the music business sought after, you know, top-notch studio musicians such as yourself, which is what we were talking about. You know, but with advances in technology and other factors, you know, that golden period has, you know, virtually faded away. And, you know, as a musician who's been through that heyday, tell us how you're adjusting to this new world in the music industry. I mean, what keeps you busy, and what kind of gigs are more common for you these days?
That's an interesting and sometimes difficult discussion, because I don't have a big tolerance. You know, a lot of people want to be playing all the time, and stay in the business and stay relevant and current, and that's where they live and breathe. And I've, in a way, you know, segued away from that as just, you know, being that being my only identity. I actually have, you know, got involved with the stock market and trading volatile volatile instruments for fun and for time consumption, and actually to, you know, to build a better base than I could with just music.
Yeah.
Music really requires you to be in everything. Writing, you know, writing maybe some kind of production of some sort.
Yeah.
But just on labor wages, you have to, you know, hit a different lottery, which is the live gig, you know, great employer lottery, which includes a small handful of, from, you know, Eric Clapton and James Taylor and those kinds of things. And those folks who keep busy with that, that's really how they're making a living.
Right.
Unless they took a TV gig like Kimmel or Letterman and that kind of thing, and let that, you know, spread into other things. But for the most part, I don't think there's a lot of room for a lot of great playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I could keep busy if I wanted to with different live things here and there, but that's kind of a grind.
Yeah.
So I only do what I want to do.
That's nice.
If a live gig comes along and it's with Quincy Jones, then I'm a yes.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
And if it's some other thing, I got a phone call from someone, I won't mention the name, but a prominent, you know, person in the music business who had a complicated thing, that went to Mexico and had to do this and that, a bunch of rehearsals for almost no money. And those things are tough to do because it just doesn't really hold my attention enough, and it seems like a lot of work.
Yeah.
You know, and I'd give my left thumb, even though I needed it, to go out and tour with Steely Dan in the heyday.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there's a lot of those things that don't really pay a lot of money, but they're so musically gratifying that you can identify with it. But there's only a few of those. You know, you can count them on two hands, all the great things that a musician would love doing.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And the rest of it is a matter for the labor of love.
While you're on that, I mean, you just mentioned that the wish list of the gigs that any musician that would really want. What was on your bucket list? Was there ever any artist or anything like that you would say, man, I would have wished to play with that person? Does that ever cross your mind? I mean, you brought it up just now.
They did it all the time. There was one on my bucket list. And,
who's that?
And it was from the time I was 17. It was Miles Davis.
Really?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah.
And other than Dave Holland, I don't think he ever hired another white bass player. That's a funny subject too, but I don't know if it's
really
appropriate for this. I mean, because there's a lot of groups that won't hire a white bass player.
Yeah.
They're not black.
Yeah. Wasn't Ron Carter? Wasn't he one of your sort of idols, bass idols?
Absolutely. Yeah. Matter of fact, most of the guys who went through Miles' band, were all idols of mine.
Jeez.
Ron Carter on those records taught me more about bass than anything, just about what, you know, how to think so far out of the box, which he did.
Yeah.
Everything he did was outside of the box. Of course, he was with a band and with music that lent itself.
Right.
The music has to be fantastic for you to really stretch. That's why, you know, you hear like people like Chuck Rainey, who are so brilliant on those Steely Dan records.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And the music's great. You can come up with great, great bass lines and great things and off the top of your head because the music is so inspiring.
Right.
That's
point. When the music is just, you know, rote, and it's just, you know, average and standard, then you're going to probably play that way.
Yeah.
But Miles's music was the most brilliant thing I had ever stumbled upon.
Yeah.
And it was all, and as I dug back from, because at my age, that was already over. When I discovered it was, I saw Miles with Dave Holland, and then he was gone, then it was Michael Henderson.
Right.
Who was easily one of the most underrated electric bass players.
Exactly.
Ever. Guy is just a brilliant feel and everything bass player.
Yeah.
Incredible. And he he's wildly underrated. But then I dug back and I bought every record and listened to everything 1,000 times of what happened in that band with Miles Davis. And Ron Carter was nothing short of brilliant. Every moment, even the mistakes were brilliant. And they were making mistakes, but I wasn't sophisticated enough to know the difference between a mistake and what was delivered. It was all brilliant.
That's great. Mm-hmm.
Ron, thankfully, is alive and he's still doing his thing, but I don't think he has the opportunity to play, you know, to play Nefertiti with Wayne Shorter and Herbie.
Exactly.
I wish he did.
Hey, Neil, I want to talk to you about the evolution of the bass as an instrument during the – how it's changed over the course of your career. And I mean basically that the instrument is, gee whiz, from the early days on a precision four-string to six to seven to eight-string basses. And what's your take on the evolution of the actual instrument itself? Has it made the instrument better? How do you see it?
Well, I'm kind of old school. In that, bass is what it is. It's just like what I was describing about how Ron sounded with Miles's band. Bass is as good as the music, and it's supportive, and it's an integral part of the music. So it's one piece of a big puzzle. So as these basses evolve, and now I think, like any other commodity that is for sale and has a business where people make them and sell them, etc. If everybody bought a Fender, you know, let's say like a James Jamerson had his favorite four-string precision and that was that, then how would the bass makers make a living? And how would they innovate a new thing and come out with something, you know, this wild and with this wood and this is connected and this neck is bolted on and this one was one big piece of wood? And when you look at all of that stuff, some of it is, it's all to the person who likes it. It's all individual.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so in the world of bass as a foundation of, or bass as part of a unit that even if it's as outstanding as a Ron Carter, or, you know, we can go through a whole bunch of different bass players that are outstanding on a piece of music.
Yeah.
Does anybody really sense any kind of difference that this guy went from a four string to a five and now it's a six, and that's, you know, the six gets into a soloistic part of bass playing. So that's another, that's a whole other area that I never really jumped into.
Okay.
Because I'm not that soloistic, not
I
really.
See. Yeah.
You know, I've had a few things here and there, but I'm nothing like some of those great soloists who live and thrive on it. But there's the great bass players that I still would listen to any minute on any record, like a Marcus or an Anthony Jackson. Yeah, they're playing anything from a four string, a regular Fender four string, to, you know, like with Anthony, a six string, and he makes the best of it.
Plays
chords up top, and that's about as far as it could go. I don't know about, you know, what is the use for a seven and or an eight. An eight. I thought it was two strings doubled up in octaves.
Yeah,
but none of that really is in my world,
mm-hmm.
and I respect it to death for all the people who make it part of their world, and so I'm just a non-authority on it because it's past me. The six-string I get, I did one little piece with a singer named Laura Dickinson who actually bought a six-string, and she said, "Here, you're going to play this."
Wow.
And I did. And I just followed instructions and we overdubbed. I had some high parts and some low parts, and then I pulled out my Tyler 5 and played another section. We had a whole bunch of fun on this little duet. But other than that, I've never really dug into that. So it's just not my area of expertise, and there are a lot of guys who are fantastic with it.
Yeah.
I mean, look at John Patitucci. That's the guy you'll talk to about, you know, how it works for him, because it sure does. Bass player we lost a few years ago, Dave Carpenter.
Yeah.
He was
unreal
on a six string.
Yep.
I mean, without a keyboard player or a guitar player, he held the harmonic bass, the harmonic, you know, part of a section with Peter Erskine and Bob Shepard. It was insanely good.
Interesting.
And so, I could never even dream to be that advanced.
Yeah.
You know, without sitting home and starting all over.
Yeah, a few minutes ago we talked about the the change in the industry. And so when you ever cross paths with young musicians, we talked about, you know, Boston being a hotbed, but whether the kids come out of Nashville and, you know, Belmont or North Texas, you know, young bassists, you know, what's ahead for them in the music biz? Do you get a chance to talk with them now, or are you sort of unplugged from that that community?
No, I do talk with them. I do, and on occasion, you know, they all want to ask, but I have to be very, very careful because like Jay Graydon had told me 6 months ago, we hit the musical lottery, and I don't know what these kids are headed into. I really don't. I don't want to predict the future. I know what I would like to see. I would like to see music and creativity start to rule the business again rather than money, which is now, you know, everything has flipped from when every record executive worshipped. Mm-hmm. They worshipped everybody they were going after from Miles to Sly Stone, and they worshipped the artists because they were in awe. And now they actually create more of the artist than they respect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They make it happen.
Yeah.
They make it happen. It's very, very money, you know, money based.
Yeah.
It's how to make the best of the money and make the most money and keep the most money.
Right.
And so I have to be cautious about, you know, how I speak to musicians who really want to do it, because I would like them to understand the whole world rather than just a narrow vision
world
of music. I'm endeavoring to start some classes and some lectures at Berkeley about musicians and money,
mm-hmm.
and how to be smart with money.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you make it big or you make it small,
yep.
that you still have to be smart. And I'm actually going to start that, and it's because I care about what you're asking is what to tell them. And that's one of the things I tell them. You know, you have to follow your heart, right? With music.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta do what you like.
Right.
If you're gonna just, you know, get a gig in the theater and play you know, get lucky enough to have a 6-7 show a week gig that mm-hmm. just pays labor wages and maybe a pension and all that, then you're just doing it for a living.
Right.
That, you know, is it in your heart? Is that music? Is that particular, you know, music for that show? Is that what you love, or would you rather be out, you know, creating a new jazz group or a metal band or whatever it may be? But you have to follow your heart, and you also have to be sensible mm-hmm. and aware of the world around you.
Right. Hey, you know, obviously we know that your discography, you've played with so many different people over the years, but one of my favorite albums that you appear on is that live album Document by Charisma. And we just had David Garfield on the show just our last episode. And I wondered about your connection with Creechy, and, you know, was it through your longtime friend Vinny Colaiuta? And tell us about your experience with Charisma.
It was the opposite. I introduced Vinny to David.
Is it? Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, when I got to town, I think the first time I played the Baked Potato was probably with Larry Carlton.
Okay,
but the Baked Potato was the center of all great musicians.
Oh yeah,
you know, Rittenour and Dave Grusin and Anthony Jackson. They did a weekly Sunday night thing there. Carlton was doing a weekly Sunday, you know, or maybe a Monday night, whatever it was. There were only 3 nights to play there because Don Randy, the owner, who was part of the Wrecking Crew, he did 4 nights. It was his club.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
He did Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday.
Okay.
So the available dates were Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. And there was a point where I was playing there with 3 different groups on Sunday night, Monday night, and Tuesday night.
Okay.
And everybody went through Baked Potato. It was the ultimate the ultimate center for great musicians.
The rite of passage.
Yeah, but I did a lot of things, got offered a lot of things there, and one of them was David's band, which was called Charisma, with Mike Landau.
Yeah.
And I remember we went over Mike's house or somebody to rehearse, and I started doing these gigs with them there. And the music was so brilliant and exciting that, you know, it's impossible to recreate, you know, except for you get an idea about it from Document. But if you came to the gig in Europe, and that was 20 years later, when all these kids, Laurent, you know, was one of them. They'd come to this club where we were set up to play, and Charisma had already gone through several different iterations before that. But they'd come in, and it was the most exciting, exhilarating thing, you know, they'd ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just that good. And I'm not taking any credit for that. The credit goes to the material that was completely outside of the box and brilliant, mostly written with Landau and David Garfield. Hmm. They wrote most of their stuff. You know, they were two peas in a pod in the late 70s. And so connecting that back to the Baked Potato, I started playing in the band at the Baked Potato, and the music was so exciting and so unique and brilliant. The place was just packed, always packed. And I remember that you know, Carlos Vega was going on the road here and there. He was the drummer, and I said if you want to hear somebody new who will blow your mind, he's out on the road with Frank Zappa. But when he comes back, I said, you've got to meet Vinny. You got to hear him.
Yeah, yeah.
And when Vinny hit the first note with these guys, it was all over.
Yeah.
If the Baked Potato was packed before Vinny was in the band, it doubled. It was just lined up door. Because he took the music to 20 levels higher.
Yeah.
And so I connected Vinny with David, but the music that David and Landau wrote it should have gone much further than it did.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of visibility and accessibility.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can only probably say that you know, Mike Landau is not, he's not big on he's not big on visibility. He likes his world just the way it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've been trying to get him on the show for a long, long, long time.
We have so many connections too, and we just can't land him. He's
Mike is an unusual character,
yeah.
And I mean that in every good sense of that and every, you know, wide sense of that.
Right.
He's really an unusual character, and he's one of the most brilliant musicians.
Oh. Yeah,
I've ever met.
Yeah,
he's like nobody else.
Yeah,
nobody else. You know, he could have been the next Hendrix, but he was so different, so sophisticated.
Yeah,
yeah.
Mike came up with chord progressions and different things, and they're all in that material. The document is only a speck of the the diverse library of Garfield and Landau songs, but it's a vehicle. The reason it came together again in 2000, because I wasn't in the band for forever, it came together because Vinny needed a vehicle to take to Germany for some things, and that was his ultimate playing vehicle.
I see.
I mean, every song is laid out in such a way with these heavy-duty, slow tempos,
yes,
and fantastic chord changes, and it's a drummer's paradise, and Vinny is a drummer's paradise. He can just, you know, blow anybody's mind with a compositional vehicle like that. Any of Landau's tunes and David's tunes were all just perfect vehicles for Vinny to show that he was one of the most advanced drummers on the planet. And that's why we did it. And then it turned into a tour out of nowhere. We had one gig, and David made a few phone calls, and it turned from a one-night gig to a couple of weeks. And we recorded that CD.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, that CD caught really early stages. It really evolved a lot more after that.
Yeah.
But we used the CD to do another tour there,
well,
you know, as a vehicle to sell it.
Yeah.
You know, you've been known to subtly blow people's minds, too. I mean, when we talk about your playing techniques, I mean, because of the diversity of the people that you've played for, like Blood, Sweat, and Tears, I mean, it could be Dolly Parton, Elton John, I mean. But when it comes down to your technique and your melodic approach, you really try to experiment sometimes in throwing some interesting notes on top of very obtuse chordings. And tell us about how you approach melodic playing.
You sure they weren't mistakes?
It could have been, and I don't even know it, man. You tell me.
Yeah, I wouldn't know it either.
Yeah. You know what I mean, though, right?
I have no real... I mean, I consider some other bass players way more advanced in those departments than me. I, you know, and it all depends on the material. I think the whole idea of recording and having a new piece of music in front of you and just going through it, is that the first time you go through it, you don't have any preconceived notions, so you don't restrict yourself. So it goes all over the place, and that's usually the one that is the throwaway. You know, they say, okay, you know, let's hone in on a few things and get it together and fix this and fix that. And sometimes that's the most creative, and some people catch it, and other times it's just what you hear in the moment. I have no real explanation for anything that I've done that somebody might think is, you know, was clever or melodic or different, other than that's what I heard in that very second, and I took a chance.
That phrasing,
And in the business, when you take a chance, there's one of two outcomes. you know, when you're finished and tape stops and it starts being discussed, somebody you know on the microphone says, "Don't do that again, please. I don't like it." And the other one is, "Wait a minute, I really like that." So it can go either way.
Yeah,
it's just taking chances.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that happens in the acting world all the time.
Oh, yes, sure.
Exactly. People ad lib, and you know, and in the extreme sense, you end up with a Robin Williams who, you know, they just pushed the button and said, "Let him go. Don't write it. Don't tell him what to do." And of course, you know, the rest is always history.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't take credit anywhere near that kind of extreme. I had some, you know, I like anybody else. I had some good moments, and I always did want to take chances.
Yeah.
I didn't. I hated safe.
Yeah.
Safe was when you know when you were on the ninth take, and it was past the point of where you still felt it was right. Fresh. Because at a certain point, it's not fresh anymore.
Yeah.
And then you just, you know, okay, this guy wants it real, real clean and real perfect, and so, you know, we'll never finish unless we do it clean and perfect.
Yeah.
So if there's anything, you know, whatever you may be referring to, it's probably because I took a chance, and it was early on when everything was fresh, and and that's what I love about music. I want something to happen that nobody's expecting.
Right.
And I had lots of those kinds of gigs live and in the studio too, where it just went in a completely different direction. If you have the right people in charge, whether it's the artist or producer, or combination of whomever, and they say, "I love that. Thank you, guys." Then you know you have a good relationship from you know the people in charge who hired you to the band. And other times they're not ready for that at all.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not. They're not open to it. Not ready for it. They want something exactly the way they've already envisioned it.
Right.
And the business did evolve slowly but surely into a much safer place where, you know, where it's already laid out in advance. You know, somebody's already done a demo with a synthesizer and all that stuff. And that's part of the evolution of music and the business. And, you know, do you think Steely Dan, if it was a new band, could get a record deal today?
Exactly.
We used to say that in the 90s. We'd say Steely Dan could never get a deal now.
Yeah, I know.
They just couldn't.
It's sad. Couldn't.
It was too sophisticated, you know.
Yeah.
Too advanced, and not where the business and the money people wanted it to go.
Yeah. You know, speaking of Steely Dan, Eddie and I always joke that, you know, he and I are both big fans of Steely Dan and Toto, and we sometimes think that, you know, that's the kind of the center of our musical world here at Inside MusicCast. But, you know, and it's because we appreciate the musicianship of these guys. But we're just curious, what's at the center of your musical universe? I know you mentioned Miles, but, you know, when you're relaxing or having time off or kicking back, what are you listening to these days?
Well, you know, we're always looking for something new. We don't always find it. The things that have blown my mind more, you know, in the past few years might have been, you know, this Jacob Collier and people who really are advanced. I'm a freak for sophisticated stuff. I don't want to hear, you know, the pop stuff. It doesn't turn me on at all. I can't even name, you know, a group or an artist. I'm thrilled that Justin Timberlake has good music and good artistry and a great band and all that, but a lot of them, you know, I watch Saturday Night Live, and I watch, you know, some of the late night talk shows, and they have people on, and it's, it all seems like it's recycled for the 20th time,
right?
And that everything, everything still goes back to when people were creative.
Yeah.
Donald Fagen came up with changes that no jazz musicians came up with. He came up with moves from modulations and things inside of hundreds of songs that just were so outside of the box that that's not the way anybody thinks.
Right.
I'm still thrilled to go hear a Herbie Hancock concert.
Yeah.
I went to the Ball recently, and there's something on PBS. There's a thing on PBS that shows a little tidbit of one of their shows, and it's absolutely so. I mean, it's just so far away from what most people even understand. Because they're taking it out harmonically, rhythmically. They're taking it so far that you have to be a music appreciator to and a musician appreciator to know how good these guys are and what they're doing. And you might be able to accuse me of living in the past somewhat. I still love anything the Yellow Jackets do. I think is brilliant.
Yeah,
Mostly it's Russell and Minter. And
right, sure.
They write great songs.
They
do. Everything about it is great. It's like Weather Report lived and evolved.
Yeah.
Yes.
In a way, it's not quite that far away, but everything they do is brilliant. And I live somewhat, you know, I'm guilty of living in the past because everything back then is still way too superior.
Yeah, I think so too.
it's a real tough thing. I've had that conversation with Quincy Jones a zillion times.
Really? That's interesting.
What do we look for? What are we listening for now?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's not like, and it's great to be relevant and to be social and to be out there, you know, with new things and go to places where music is being played and where it's being celebrated. But it's a lot harder, and I guess I've become too discriminating in what I enjoy listening to.
Yeah.
You mentioned Jacob Collier as somebody that's sort of new that you're interested in. Are you familiar with Snarky Puppy and sort of their whole ground up?
Yeah, I've heard that stuff too.
Yeah, they're pretty
very
amazing.
Good. You know, but these guys want to play.
Yeah,
they want to be on top of that you know sophisticated, relevant music curve. It's just not an easy thing to do and hold it together and make it in the business. You need to put 100% of your time into it and have a following that is loyal. And
they do. You know, I've been to several of their concerts, and every time I've been to one, they sell out. They're it's packed. So I mean,
that is absolutely a blessing.
And most importantly, it's a younger crowd.
It is.
So that's what
that's a blessing.
Yeah.
because that needs to be. To be really, you know, if somebody could market that properly and get it out to the people whoever's marketing, you know, the latest, you know, I don't even know the names, but whoever's the newer Britney Spears out there, you know, if music could be spread out and people could be exposed to a higher quality, there's nothing stopping people from enjoying it liking it and changing their tastes. But you know, there's a big part of the pop world that's just, it's kind of like brainwashing. It's played everywhere over and over again, a simple melody, a simple hook, and people hear it enough, and that's where they go. And so then when they go somewhere and they hear something like Snarky Puppy and it's really a foreign to them, they have a tough time, you know, adjusting to it.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
It's really musician lovers who go for the really good music.
Yeah.
And it's not like the old days when there was, you know, there was something simple that might have been the Eagles or James Taylor, and it was simpler, but it was still so organic and real and heartfelt.
Mm-hmm.
It was all good music, and good was good, and you know, and mediocre was mediocre. But now it just there's not a lot of it.
No.
I would rather hear someone else's list to say, give me a list of really excellent stuff that's all, you know, that's all current and new and relevant.
Yeah.
Because I just look and see that James Taylor is still selling places out.
Yes.
And all these other artists are selling out because they're good.
Yeah.
No doubt.
You know, there's no new Sting who comes along and has brilliant singing and songwriting and plays it too and, you know, and blows people's minds. It's just not happening.
Yeah.
And then there's the business, and the business is tough, you know, and there's the musicians used to make money from concerts, and now they have to sell the concert to Live Nation, and they package it, and they package it based on algorithms and demographics that have to do with, you know, well, let's see, if we put Paul Simon together with Sting, then, or Peter Gabriel, then we can get this audience and that audience, and we can combine it and maximize, you know, and then there's resellers who buy tickets for $150 and sell them for $500. And
right.
It's a crazy business, and it kind of dilutes. It dilutes, you know, the potential of what the music could be,
mm-hmm.
with all that stuff in the way.
Yeah.
It's my sense of it.
Yeah.
Well, Neil, it's,
but I don't see another Sting coming along and just blowing people's minds.
Yeah. Well, Neil, you're in good company here with our audience and us here at Inside Musicast, because everything you're saying is just pushing our buttons, and I know a lot of our listeners
that
feel
that makes
that
sense
way.
Because we all kind of stick together. You know, I just came from the NAMM show, you know, walking around and watching all these potential musicians picking up every instrument and banging and blowing horns and doing all that stuff and the whole computer department.
Yeah.
And I see that there's a thriving business, or there seems to be.
Yeah.
I would just love to see that that corporate and dollar-driven incentives can be stripped away so that the musicians rule the day. Because there's nothing wrong with the amount of musicians coming up and what they want to know and how they are hungry to learn and learn to be incredible. There's nothing lacking there. What's lacking is support.
Yeah.
And the support has to be, you know, has to take all those people who have dollar signs in their eyes out of it.
Right.
Because then the dollar signs, you know, they dominate
the
whole picture. And that dilutes, you know, the potential for great music.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Hey, Neil, just in closing here, what does 2018 hold for you that you can talk to us about? Is it, you have any projects on the horizon or things that you're working on now?
I recently just did a project for a Mexican group that I love. I love these people. They're so nice, and they're apparently huge in Mexico, but nobody knows about them here, called Los Temerarios.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a couple other projects. I can't even remember the guy's name, but there was a South African singer who was just incredible. That was kind of a one-day thing. And there's been a few other things, but there's not a ton. There's all little calls that are one day here and one day there that are just, you know, some of them are Japanese projects and things like that.
Yeah. It's
the appreciators for the better musicians are not necessarily domestic. It's interesting.
It's funny. It's
true.
There's the Japanese folks that call us to play, and the Hispanic artists and producers, they seem to have more of a grasp on the quality that they want to achieve, and they like it real. They like a real drum performance at the same time as the bass performance and a guitar. You know, they want that. I don't really see that with the others. It's interesting because domestically, they're sitting inside with a machine.
Right. Yep.
So I don't know. I really don't know. And sometimes things happen. You know, I'll get a call tonight to be somewhere tomorrow. That could happen. That's probably more likely than me having something, you know, that I know I'm going to do in April or whatever.
Right.
but and I'm not, and I haven't been doing much of the touring thing. You know, I'm kind of picky, and I think people already know that, and so I'm not really in the running for a lot of that kind of stuff that others might be.
That's okay.
And I hear about, you know, all my friends who are on a bus for 4 weeks, and they're exhausted.
yeah,
they're exhausted because nobody wants to spend any money making it comfortable.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I have friends touring all over the place, you know, some with Fleetwood Mac and Stevie Nicks or, you know, things of that sort. And they are living on a bus.
Yeah.
That's the business.
that's the business.
It is.
Yeah. It is.
That's what it is. And that just sounds, that's not appealing to me.
Well.
It sounds too tough.
Well, what has been appealing for us is to have a good chance here as we end to talk with you and get to know with you. Neil, thank you so much for spending time with us. You know, it's
my pleasure.
You've had a great chat.
I could do it for hours.
Oh, man. And we'll do it again.
Hey, Neil, thank you so much. We're out of time, but we do want to have you back on the show, and we'll definitely keep in touch. And we'll definitely
we could talk music business. business and, you know, and what musicians should do. And
that's right.
You know, and how it all kind of intertwines and what we should do next.
Absolutely. You got it, man.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Neil.
No problem at all.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Special thanks to Neil Steubenhaus for joining us on this episode of Inside MusicCast. We'd also like to thank our correspondents, Brian Pearson, Kim Riley, Scott Gross, Mikhail Engstrom, Don Brightup, Scott Sheriff, Loretta Sassaman, Yinka Oyelese, and Arnaud Legere for their continued support and content development. Inside MusicCast is powered by Earshot Audio Post and Cabello Associates. Inside MusicCast Radio is back and is playing West Coast, AOR, jazz, pop, and funk, and is streaming now at InsideMusicCast.com, TuneIn, or download the free apps for iOS and Android devices. For Eddie Cabello, I'm Rick Such. Thanks for listening to Inside MusicCast and Inside MusicCast Radio.